for KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio here on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, rebroadcast all over Southern California and all around the world at kpfk.org. I'm Scott Horton. I'm assistant editor at antiwar.com and host the Anti-War Radio Project there and on the Liberty Radio Network. And we've had a big week at antiwar.com covering the Afghan war, particularly the numerous civilians slaughtered in airstrikes in the past week, the Iraq war, and specifically blame being leveled at Iran for interference in Iraqi affairs. The disaster in Libya continues to rain on. We've been covering that, as well as drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia, the drug war in Mexico, and of course we've been keeping track of the Arab summer now in Egypt, in Morocco, in Yemen, Syria, and of course Palestine. Also at antiwar.com, we cover the war at home this week, including stories about the Army's handheld biometric devices being passed out to local law enforcement across the United States, and another new bogus entrapment terrorism case by the FBI. I've had an extremely busy week myself on Anti-War Radio. Today I talked with Salon.com's Glenn Greenwald about Wired finally releasing now the complete transcripts of the chat logs between the greatest whistleblower in human history, Bradley Manning, and the rat, Adrian Lamo. And talked with Glenn all about the truths revealed in these chat logs. Yesterday, I spoke with Jeremy Scahill about his huge new piece in TheNation.com about the secret CIA and Joint Special Operations Command war in Somalia, their secret prison there, and Obama-era renditions. I also spoke with Fred Bronfman, who had an excellent piece at Alternet about the new, quote-unquote, counterterrorism strategy up in the air. Seymour Hersh might call it. Eric Margolis was on the show this week to discuss U.S., French, and Israeli intervention in the revolution in Syria. Adam Morrow spoke on the state of the revolution in Egypt. Pepe Escobar from the Asia Times was on to talk about the Libyan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan wars. Laura Pitter from Human Rights Watch was on to talk about their new report urging the indictment of the Bush administration principals for torture and war crimes. Michael Hastings from Rolling Stone magazine was on to talk about the Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq wars. Ray McGovern spoke on the sabotage of the Gaza flotilla, literally and figuratively, by the United States and Israel, grounding it in its port in Greece. And Mohamed Sahimi was on the show this week as well to talk about the American Empire's support of the communist terrorist cult, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, and their political front in the United States, the National Council for Resistance in Iran, and the push by the War Party to have these American murdering terrorists delisted from the State Department's terrorist group list so that they can receive more American funding to commit more terrorist attacks, funnel more bogus intelligence from the Israelis into the American intel stream, etc., like that. All of those interviews either are available or will be available at antiwar.com/radio in just the next few days. All right, y'all. And, you know, before we get to our guest tonight, let me say another couple of words here about Jeremy Scahill's piece in The Nation. It's called The CIA's Secret Sites in Somalia. And Jeremy Scahill and his partner Rick Rowley went to Somalia and spent quite a few weeks there. They have dozens of sources from American intelligence, the so-called Somali government, the al-Shabaab militia, former prisoners and human rights people and all sides, and tell an incredible story about this war that's been raging in Somalia that America started really back after September 11th, backing the warlords that were our enemies back during Black Hawk Down, and succeeded only in provoking the rise of this Islamic Courts Union, which then the Americans forced the Ethiopians to invade Somalia in Christmas 2006 to overthrow. It was only then that al-Shabaab, as Scahill explained in the interview on my show yesterday, which was the smallest and least important faction of the Islamic Courts Union, rose to prominence as the young, fighting-age male guerrilla resistance help for the Islamic Courts Union to defeat and drive the Ethiopian army out, which they did. America is now in the position of backing former members of the Islamic Courts Union against the al-Shabaab militia that really only rose up into existence to help them thwart America's will. This is the entire terrorism war in a nutshell in Somalia. First we intervene, then we provoke enemies, then we support some enemies against old enemies, and have a brand new war on our hands. And if you read any media about Somalia at all, they'll tell you about the al-Shabaab militia, their close ties to al-Qaeda, and how something must be done, without ever explaining that America's been doing something there in Somalia for years on end now, and have created the mess, the humanitarian catastrophe, and the rise of the al-Shabaab movement. Now, as Scahill and Rowley are reporting, the CIA has a brand new base there in Mogadishu, with a secret underground dungeon prison, where prisoners are renditioned and kept secret from the Red Cross. The drone strikes are increasing, and matters promise only to get worse. There are very few places in this country where you can find any decent coverage of Somalia whatsoever. This show will continue to be one of them. Again, that article is called The CIA's Secret Sites in Somalia, published in The Nation magazine, available also at thenation.com. Now, when Gareth Porter writes something, I bring him on the show to talk about it. And he has written something for Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, original.antiwar.com/Porter. In fact, just antiwar.com/Porter. We'll forward you right on there. The latest is called What is Sauder's Game on Future U.S. Troop Presence? Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks, Scott. Glad to be on again.
Okay. Now, here's the thing. You sit there for a second. I'm going to make a couple of assertions, and then I'm going to turn it over to you. So,
okay.
It used to be that the Ba'ath Party ruled Iraq. It was predominantly a Sunni party, especially at the highest levels, and they're the Arabs are the majority in Iraq as opposed to the Kurds, but the Sunnis are the minority among the Arabs in Iraq. And so then America invaded and overthrew the Ba'athists and fought a giant civil war on behalf of the Badr Brigade of the Supreme Islamic Council and the Mahdi Army of Muqtada al-Sadr, and safely completed the ensconcing of them in power in Baghdad in, say, 2007-08. They finally pretty much finished up winning that civil war. And so now their only problem is there's this religious leader on the Shiite majority side that we've fought this war to install in power who wants us to go or not. Tell us about Muqtada al-Sadr.
Well, first of all, just one point that I would make, which is a bit different from the presentation, which is that you just made, which is otherwise perfectly correct, and that is that Sadr, although he did not resist the initial U.S. Invasion of Iraq, it's quite true, within 1 year or year and a half, he had begun a military resistance to the U.S. and has maintained that degree of resistance to U.S. presence in varying degrees, I guess I should say, a resistance to U.S. presence ever since. And of course, it's important to understand that the real, within the Shiite community or the Shia community, the real big conflict here has been between the Bader Brigade people, who represent the middle and upper class of the Shia community, and Sadr, whose constituency clearly is the poor and dispossessed of the Shia community. So that's part of the background, I think, of this story. So now, what is Sadr's game here? He has...
Well, wait a minute. Hold the Sadr's game, because as long as you're going to go ahead and clarify that, we should also clarify that Abdulaziz al-Hakim, the leader of the Badr faction, the Supreme Islamic Council, has died. His son didn't have the wherewithal to hold it together. And Muqtada al-Sadr is now the dominant force inside the Iraqi Supreme Islamic Council, as well as the Iraqi National Alliance, the majority party that rules the parliament and supports Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister.
Correct.
He resisted, and our guys fought battles with him from time to time over the years, but still the war was to make him the Ayatollah, basically, whether that's what they were trying to do or not. Right.
No, I think that is in fact the larger and longer term effect of the U.S. war. That is absolutely correct. But nevertheless, in the wake of the Shiite, basically their victory over the Sunnis in the civil war in 2006, 2007, the fact is that the United States and Sadr are still very much at odds. And so, Sadr is a very complex figure politically at this point. And really, this is the main point of my article, is that he apparently wants to play an ambiguous, two-sided, double game, if you will, with regard to the U.S. presence there, despite the fact that he continues publicly to rail against the U.S. military presence, and indeed has continued to carry out military attacks on U.S. military targets. Nevertheless, the evidence now is that he is trying to maneuver so that the Nouri al-Maliki government can allow or reach an agreement, that he will allow an agreement between the government and the United States to station U.S. troops. And this is coming from the Office of Iraqi Military Intelligence, which is responsible for relations between the al-Maliki government and Sadr. And this is an office called the International Liaison Office, which is run by former East German intelligence officer who, in fact, later on became Sadr's political advisor, precisely when the United States was trying to carry out major attacks and to weaken the Mahdi army in 2007-2008. So this is a very important development, that Sadr now, because of his very ambiguous on and off relationship with Nouri al-Maliki, which is now on, he is telling al-Maliki that he will not try to bring the government down by opposing the U.S. opposing any request by Maliki for a continued U.S. military presence. And that is something very new, because it's the first time that he has made a move towards an accommodation with the U.S. presence. Of course, this is not public, it's all private, and this is something that is at odds with Sadr's public position. Now, the other side of this coin at this point is that the United States military, certainly, and other U.S. officials who are working on Iraq are not buying the idea that Sadr has changed his stripes on opposing the U.S. military presence. They are still saying, and they were telling me when I was writing this story, we don't see any clear evidence or any evidence at all in the case of the U.S. military that Sadr has changed. His Promise Day Brigade is still carrying out attacks against the United States. They're responsible for having killed U.S. troops. And as far as they're concerned, Sadr is still the enemy. So you have a very, very interesting situation where he's trying to accommodate U.S. presence in this very complicated way, and the U.S. military does not believe it, and they are still demanding that he essentially dismantle the Promise Day Brigade. That's the only way they'll be satisfied that Sadr is ready to make peace with the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and he's not going to do that. I mean, it's clear that he's not going to do it. So it's not at all clear that he can, in fact, carry out an accommodation with the U.S. that will be acceptable to the U.S. And that conflict apparently is going to continue.
Well, now, so recent attacks on American troops had been attributed to his militia. You disagree?
Well, you know, I think that the evidence is that, in fact, Promised Aid Brigades not only carried out attacks, but those attacks did, in fact, cause U.S. casualties. How many and how much of the total casualties is another question. It was in June, 15 American troops in Iraq were killed, which is the highest figure since June of 2008. So that's very significant. And, of course, you can assume that there's a multiple of that which were wounded as well. I have no doubt that some of those casualties are attributable to the Promised Aid Brigade. And you know, the people who were telling me this, you know, giving me this story, wanted to minimize as much as possible the killed and wounded that can be attributed to the Promised Aid Brigade, but they cannot absolutely say that there were no casualties caused by the Sadr attack on the U.S. troops. But I think that there is some reason to believe that Sadr was, in fact, while attacking the U.S. Targets, U.S. military targets, meaning U.S. bases and convoys, he was not trying to cause maximum casualties. I think that's probably true. And so there's a nuance here. There's an effort by Sadr to minimize the casualties, which is simply not being accepted, or believed by the U.S. military.
It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gareth Porter from Interpress Service and antiwar.com/Porter. The latest piece is called What is Sadr's Game on Future U.S. Troop Presence? Now, Gareth, I think you say in this article, and you were alluding to this a minute ago, that there are indications that July is different from June, that maybe if Sadr was orchestrating attacks against American forces last month, that something's happened to change his mind in the meantime, or there are indications that he had ordered a new strategy.
Right, and I think the important, the first thing that I haven't mentioned, which needs to be added to this storyline, is that according to this ILO, the arm of the Iraqi military intelligence, which handles relations with Sadr for al-Maliki, basically there was a major, not a physical meeting, but an exchange of views between Sadr and Maliki last weekend. And what happened in that exchange of views was that basically Maliki wanted to know point blank what Sadr's intentions were. Was he going to use a request for troops, U.S. troops, to stay in Iraq against the government and try to bring it down? Or was he ready to support the government or to continue to support the government and not try to use that issue politically? And in the background, of course, was Sadr's previous threat to reactivate the Mahdi army, which in fact has been deactivated since 2009. And so basically Sadr responded to that by assuring Maliki that he would not try to bring the government down, that he would not obstruct or stand in the way of a request for U.S. troops. And so this was a major move by Sadr, and he then issued a public statement on his website, which, you know, in a very sort of low-key way, tipped his hand, if you will, by saying that he would not reactivate the Mahdi army, and explained that because there was corruption and malfeasance in the Mahdi army, that they were not ready to be reactivated, so he was not going to do that, as he had threatened to do in April, if U.S. troops continued to remain in Iraq past the December 2011 deadline. And he also essentially said that the Promised Aid Brigade would be the only force that would have the authorization to resist U.S. troops, and they would do so only if U.S. troops remained beyond the deadline. So in other words, he was saying that between now and the end of the deadline, that the Promised Day Brigade would stand down, which of course is another, you know, could be viewed, and I think should be viewed as another signal by Sadr with regard to his intentions. So there are a number of things that are going on here which point in that direction. But it still remains true that Sadr cannot afford to stop military resistance to any continued U.S. presence because he'll lose his following. He simply cannot be in a position of accepting the U.S. military presence publicly. And so, you know, my source was telling me that if the U.S. military presence does remain, of course Sadr will have to continue to make attacks on U.S. bases and convoys. But he would do so in a way that would be aimed at not causing large numbers of dead or wounded. So it's a very, very subtle approach that Sadr apparently is taking on this, trying to have it both ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say in your article he was telling his people, shoot only at very hard targets, like armored vehicles with really good armor on them. So there will have been an attack today, but no one will have gotten seriously hurt. He's really worried about picking a major fight and the war starting all over again. He doesn't have the power to repel a full-scale invasion of East Baghdad, and et cetera.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know what his calculus is with regard to, you know, how much he fears of having a new military confrontation with the United States. That may be part of his calculus, that he doesn't want to, you know, have that kind of, you know, large-scale confrontation. I think also that, you know, part of his calculus, which I didn't discuss in the piece but is important, is that, you know, he really sees himself now as the kingmaker, clearly, in the Iraqi government. He's not going to take an official position, presumably. I don't think that's what he has in mind. But what he does believe is that the next prime minister after al-Maliki is undoubtedly going to be a Sadrist. He is going to be in a position to choose the next leader of Iraq. And so it's going to be his government in the future. And what he's being told is, look, our military is not capable of guarding our borders. It's too weak. We need the Americans here to give us training and to help us ward off any foreign threat. And they're telling him that Iran is a foreign threat. And despite the fact that Sadr, you know, has indeed gotten training from Iran in the past and no doubt has gotten money from Iran, I think that he is listening to what they're saying, and he's responding to that. He's ready to allow some U.S. military presence there to help the Iraqi military, which is still, the Iraqi military itself is the leading force in Iraq trying to get the United States military to retain troops there. That's their baby. They think that's in their interest. And so there is this byplay between the Iraqi military and Sadr that is apparently resulting in his change of mind, at least privately, if not publicly.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, really, he wouldn't have to fight. All he'd have to do is just tell Maliki, I'm withdrawing support from you. We could vote no confidence or whatever and get rid of Maliki and put a Sadrist in there as soon as he felt like, really, at this point. But you're saying that his incentive is for now to let Maliki stay and to let the Americans stay to ward off the Iranians.
Right, his and of course, you know, as my source told me, look, I mean, he's going to continue publicly to be against the American military presence, and he'll continue to carry out attacks. He has to do that because otherwise he loses his constituency. So, I mean, that's how complicated this situation is. He is indeed playing a double game. He's inheriting power, and at the same time, he needs to hold on to his Shia constituency because that is indeed what allows him to hold that power.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just like the you know, surge in 2007 and 2008. It was half fighting the Sadrists in East Baghdad and half helping them finish off the Sunnis and helping them win a final victory for Baghdad. It's an 85% Shiite city now. That was the Mahdi army that did, you know, I don't know, half of that ethnic cleansing.
But I think, you know, that the U.S. military was not consciously trying to help the Mahdi army do that. I think it was still happening despite the U.S. military. I mean,
they were trying to help the Badr Brigade do it.
And well, absolutely.
It ended up benefiting Sadr more because,
absolutely,
as you said, he represents a lot more Shia.
They were prepared to help the Badr Brigade up to a point. I don't think they were prepared to help the Mahdi army at all. And so I think it was happening despite the wishes of the U.S. military. They did not want to help the Mahdi army consolidate power at the expense of the Sunnis, but they were not able to do that much about it in 2007. They were still in a position where, the Mahdi army could still operate pretty freely, although there were some places where the U.S., if you read Nir Rosen's book, you find that there were some places in Baghdad where U.S. military was effectively blocking the Mahdi army's operations.
Really? Oh, I actually have Nir Rosen's book. I haven't read that part.
Yeah, it's very good on that. It's very informative, and it tells, I think, more fully than any other source the story of the complications that attended the U.S. surge, particularly in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. The only problem with that is, in real time, on this show, with you as a guest and with others, we talked about all this then, that they can fight Muqtada al-Sadr in East Baghdad if they want, but as long as they're helping the Badr Brigade finish the cleansing, so-called, of the Sunni Arabs from Baghdad, ultimately Sadr's going to be the kingmaker here, because as you said, Hakim only represented the rich Shia, and the vast majority of the Shia ain't rich. He's the only one with legitimate bottom-up power.
I think the U.S. military and civilian people running the show simply were not sharp enough to figure that out in 2007.
They should listen to anti-war radio, I guess. They should read IPS News.
That's
antiwar.com/Porter. Thanks very much for your time, Gareth. Really
Thanks for having me again, Scott.
All right, y'all, and that does it for the show tonight. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. We're here every Friday from 6:30 to 7 o'clock in Los Angeles here on KPFK 90.7. FM. Again, all the archives of my interviews, including from this week, Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, Fred Bronfman, Adam Morrow, Pepe Escobar, Laura Pitter, Michael Hastings, Ray McGovern, Mohammed Sahimi, are all available or will be available very soon at antiwar.com/radio. Thanks very much for listening. See you guys next week.